This is the second day of this September 2016 two-day Sesshin, and we'll be returning to and reading from the life and teachings of Russell Williams, the book's title, Not I, Not Other Than I. We spoke yesterday of Russell and his long journey to his awakening at the age of 29. And I would like to start, there's some clarifying things, but I'd like to start with reading just a short part of his immediately post-awakening experience, because it gives a flavor of this this being, and it gives more depth, I think, to reading other sections of the book. The chapter is called Horses and Healing. This new state was odd, but one became attuned to it in a way that it wasn't other than itself. It was very difficult to explain. I'd never expected to experience anything like it. I thought about telling other people about it, but I realized that I couldn't. They'd think I was mad. But it stayed with me. I felt like I wasn't myself anymore and began to wonder if I really existed, because it was such a different existence. I had the same body, was still doing the same work, but with a completely different nature of mind. It was a new life without a future. I felt a sense of oneness towards everything. There is nothing which was not of the same nature. Now I can understand the biblical aspect of this. In the beginning, there was nothing, no thing, just emptiness. Out of that emptiness, things began to materialize. And that's why space is the most important quality in the whole universe. I'd been looking for happiness, but now I began to realize that happiness is delusion. It's based on having certain things or achieving certain things. It depends on external circumstances, which can change at any moment. It is conditioned. But the contentment I found then, and still have now, is unconditioned. It doesn't require anything. It doesn't matter what you have or whether you have anything at all. Just to be is a state of well-being. In this state, everything is interesting. You're never bored. Everything is interesting because it's all a part of the same consciousness. And there's nothing selfish about this. We don't find contentment through gaining anything, but through losing ourselves. And at the same time, we are never lonely, even if we're alone. Loneliness never arises because we see all things as part of ourselves. There is no separateness and no fear. As we moved around in and out of fields, there were some strange incidents. On one occasion, the chap who looked after the wild animals was crushed and had to go to hospital. Remember, he worked in a circus. So I took over his duties. At that time, there was a cage at the side of the ring in which the wild animals performed. That was attached to a tunnel to their traveling quarters. Consequently, one was able, first thing in the morning, to run them down into the big cage while you cleaned out their dens. This was the first job in the morning, so that's what I did. I opened up the gate to the big cage and released the door to let them out. I pulled out the slides which kept them in separate compartments, so they had free access. So they all went down into the cage, and I shut the door and bolted it. There was no one else about apart from me. Their dens were in an old gray carriage divided into three sections with slides. One side of it was completely barred, but not solid. In the middle, there was a little gate about 3 foot high and 2 foot wide, which was usually bolted with a padlock. I unlocked it, opened up the door, and went in with a brush and started brushing up the old sawdust, working my way from one end to the other. I'm right in the corner, sweeping away, and suddenly I stop and look around. There's the male lion halfway through the entrance at the other end. This time I've really had it, I thought. There he was, his front two paws already over the entrance and raising his third leg to come over. I thought, I don't stand a chance. And the next thing I knew, I was standing 10 feet outside the cage, watching the lion bringing his other legs in. The door was locked, and the padlock was on, locked. To this day, I don't know how it happened. It was as if I was teleported. Then there was a time when we went to Dublin, to the Theatre Royal, over Christmas. On the way back, I loaded my luggage onto the boat, then went back on shore. I left my identity card in my luggage, and the captain wouldn't allow me on without it, even though I'd already been on and off to load it. So I was stuck in Dublin for an extra couple of days, with no means of support, waiting, while the rest of the show went back to England. While I was there, I found myself picking up a great deal of agitation from the horses. I was deeply disturbed. I couldn't understand what was going on. Something was distressing them very deeply. What the hell could it be? Eventually, I retrieved the identity card and sailed over from Dunlera a few days later. I hitchhiked my way to our winter quarters, arriving about 3 o'clock in the morning, and made my way to the stables. There was no light, but everything was familiar. I knew precisely where everything was. As I was walking through, something grabbed me by the ankle and threw me to the ground. I'm fighting something in the dark. I can feel its fur. I find its neck and start squeezing it, and it gives in. I know animals. Once they've given in, it's over. So I let it go, knowing it won't fight back. I find the hurricane lamp, light it, and realize I've been fighting a baboon, a chacma baboon. It was on a chain, enough to allow it to run around a few yards, but not long enough to reach the horses. I realized that was why the horses were distressed, a strange animal they couldn't understand. I was so bonded with them that I'd picked up their feelings from hundreds of miles away. So now we'll go to other parts of the book. And first, to clarify a little bit the difference between concentration and mindfulness. Zen is a concentration practice, which also involves mindfulness, of course, but it's really important to understand what the concentration aspect develops and what it means to our practice. So he says this about concentration. Consider the Buddhist concept of concentration. This isn't mental concentration in the normal sense. It's the gathering together of all the sense perceptors in one place within the body, which is that stillness and emptiness. It's like taking the colors of the spectrum, putting them on a disc, and spinning them so that there is complete white. In the same way, here there is a massive clarity that enables us to see things that we couldn't otherwise know. This is the grand awakening when all things come together. Then there's no separateness. I'm not asking you to believe this. I don't want you to believe. It's something for you to ponder. I don't want belief at all. If you ponder things and look for yourself, you'll discover whether it's true or false. If it's false, that's fine. Reject it and tell me I'm wrong. I don't mind. I might be deluded. It is not a vast change. You're already only a step away, and this is the next step. It is normal. When did the baby become the boy become the teenager a man? It was normal in every way. Every day along the way, your life has been ordinary, and yet you are totally different to what you were. In the same way, when you take the next step in your practice, it will be ordinary, nothing spectacular. How could it not be? Unless, of course, there was a sudden transformation which would probably drive you mad since the difference would be so vast. I actually wandered off concentration a bit here, but I would like to just address this whole issue of grasping in practice, and especially for people who been working for a very long time and feel somewhat discouraged, not satisfied with where things are at. And so he's responding to a student or a participant who says, I feel as if I'm evolving gradually towards a more spiritual state, but everybody I know about who has become enlightened or realized seems to have had a sudden dramatic experience, some kind of crisis. Do you think that is always the case? Russell. I wouldn't say that necessarily. It may appear that way, but generally speaking, people have had experiences in previous lives which have brought them to this point. Now, for beginners, if you struggle with past lives, no problem. Don't have to believe it at all. But for Russell, it's a fact that he certainly experienced and believes in. Even in this life, there's usually a period when they have concentrated intensely for a long period of time. In my own case, there were 3 years, day and night, looking after animals, a whole process for a long period. Ramana Maharshi had a few years. He had a glimpse when he tried to experience death, but it still took another 10 years. He was about 27 when he finally became awakened. It's not just sudden. The previous experiences make a difference. A lot of work takes place in the past before we come into this lifetime, and in this lifetime. In my case, I knew this was my last time around. I wasn't even looking for enlightenment this time around, which seems to be the right way when I look back on it. The only thing you can do to prepare the way is to clear the mind. It's no good trying to think and understand it. It won't work. What you have to do is to train yourself to be more fully aware of what you're doing. That's why I instruct people to put their mind in their hands and be consciously aware. Let your hands tell you what you want to do rather than the other way around. This helps to clear your mind. And when you reach the stage where you virtually have a clear mind, there is the chance of something arising. It's within you already. It's your own nature in the first place. As long as you're not concerned about where you're going, just what you're doing now is in the physical feeling rather than a mental one, you'll find that awareness will take you to deeper levels, much more subtle areas, where you can observe your emotions without getting involved. That's a very important point. You can observe your emotions without getting involved. You see them, you let them go. And then you see the nature of the mind, how concepts are formed and how they disappear. Emptiness is the key, the clear, empty mind, what we would call samadhi. But short of samadhi, we all experience this in sesshin, the gradual settling into stillness. Emptiness is the key, the clear, empty mind. Whatever you observe becomes the whole content of the mind. You gain access into a totally new dimension from which all these things arise. In Buddhist terms, this is the unborn, uncreated, unmanifest, which is the essence of everything. Another participant in relation to this asks, I know what I need to do, and I find solace in the spiritual side of things. He says, yes, but the spiritual side works in a different way. You can't grasp at it, which is what makes it difficult for you. You're used to grasping at things to prove yourself. No matter what you have, you will never be wholly content whilst you have the attitude of, I could do with a little more, or I could do a little better. If you go to the gym and start lifting weights, you develop big muscles. When you grasp at things, you become good at grasping. When you take on things, you become good at taking things on, and the more you do, the stronger this desire becomes. Whatever you work at becomes stronger. The only way to overcome it is not to work at it, but to allow it to atrophy, to fade away. Now, in regard to practice, we really do have to make effort. Effort is the key. You have to assert your will over and over and over as the practice becomes dry, or you get full of thoughts, emotions, things come up. But what he's saying is to be easy. I think what he's saying here is to be easy. The grasping is in the future somehow, and we have to be totally in the present. He continues, we tend to cling to the things that bring us suffering, but not the things which give us freedom. When you're reasonably happy, you're open-minded and would give anything away. But with a little depression, you close everything into yourself and develop actually a bigger ego because you're so aware of yourself. When you're happy, you aren't aware of yourself. You're so open that you don't realize there is a self. So being selfless means happiness. As long as you don't try to contain it and leave it wide open, you will. As long as you don't try to contain it and leave it wide open, you will always be content. It means that you can't get hurt, as if you're so soft that things just bounce off you or you just absorb them. Whereas in the other mode, you're rigid and hard, so things strike against you and you do get hurt. Usually we grasp at our sorrows and our pains. We cling to them and make them us. I am suffering. When you're content, you don't register them. You're so open, at one with things, that there are no problems. And if you look back over your life, you'll find there have been quite a few of these periods of contentment. They're not forgotten, although the negative periods may stand out because they hurt more. Many people today have a dim view of themselves because they identify themselves with the hardships rather than the lighter side of life. Look closely, and you will see that the lighter side is there. Many people don't seem to understand that you can sit back and be yourself and be content without grasping for anything. In fact, you're better off being empty than being bombarded with information. Be empty, open, let things come and go. You can know what's going on, but you don't have to make it your own. You can't do much about it anyway. And from that, we go into segue into making spiritual progress. And the question is, how can one know when one is making spiritual progress? You can't. It's only when a situation shows you that you have changed that you realize. At all points, no matter where you are in your life, it is normal. The normality changes, but you don't notice it. You realize you've changed by noticing what you've lost, not what you've gained. For instance, you might recall that earlier on, you used to get angry very quickly about certain things. But now, when similar things happen, you find you don't get angry at all. You've lost the grasping at that situation that made you get angry, or at least it has weakened. These are the things that show us we've progressed. But unless the situation arises, we don't become aware of the progress. You don't realize something is lost until you realize you want it and find it's not there. That's why it's difficult. You could be well along the path and not know it unless some little incident shows you, I used to be like that and I'm not anymore. It could be a long time before that situation arises. That's why it's known as a gradual path. Other people may see it, but you yourself don't. Now we go into thoughting, which is the reason we do a concentration practice, is because that is the method or the way to distancing ourselves from the thoughting mind. When we first start practice, we think we are our thoughts. We're absolutely convinced, well, this is me. This is, you know, what I'm thinking, everything like that. And as we practice a little longer, we begin to be able to see that chaotic mind and see the thoughts. And, we then as we do the concentration practice, it interferes with our ability to stay in that default mode of daydreaming and thoughting. So I'm going to read this little chapter, "You Are Not the Body." How do we know we are separate from thinking and from the physical? By your own observation. You might think, I know I am me, I am me, I'm in control of what I do and what I think. Suppose I tell you that you're not, would you believe it? If you're in control, why do you think thoughts you don't want to think? How do you know you're thinking thoughts you don't want to think? Is there something separate which watches thinking going on? If you're watching, who is doing the thinking? If you're thinking, who is doing the watching? So somewhere we have to make a separation. If thinking is a process of the brain, which is part of the body, it's merely a process going on within the physical structure. Therefore, I am the watcher. I am the consciousness that sees the process. Therefore, I'm not the body. Is that possible? Consciousness is spirit, not physical. If it were otherwise, the body would know all of this without organs of consciousness. The body is not all that important apart from as a vehicle. It's the base in which our conscious perceptors reside. Sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell. But take those away and who are you? There's nothing. We are the consciousness that works through the body, although it is not of the body. As we move along quietly, we begin to see that we are not confined to the body, and when it passes, the body leaves us free. All physical things are constructs out of that consciousness, necessary and useful because there is duality rather than unity, and you can learn far more quickly from duality than you can through a unity process. I would maintain that these animal bodies have no particular intelligence of their own. Consciousness is the intelligence itself. And since consciousness was there before the body does not create it, but vice versa. Instincts are direct recognitions of consciousness itself rather than the body. It's not easy to understand that consciousness and the thought activities or physical activities are not the same, but with a little care and attention, particularly when you find yourself thinking thoughts that you wish you didn't have and which you can't get rid of, you realize that it's as though there are two of you. There's the chaotic thinking mind and the part of you which is observing that chaotic mind and its thought content. Within the thought mind itself, there is an emotional attachment which gives it a strength and a flavor, whereas the consciousness aspect is observing in a detached way, almost as if it's saying, what's all this about? We don't really need this. While the nature of the thought aspect is chaotic, particularly with the addition of emotion, the nature of the observing aspect is quite peaceful, completely free of disturbance. These are two direct opposites, and which one are you? Are you the observer, or are you the doer? If you are the doer, you lose the observing aspect of consciousness. But if you accept that you are the watcher instead, then you begin to see that the doer or thinker is not you, but a process going on over which you have no control. Once you see this, ego begins to diminish. And we gradually begin to realize that consciousness is what I truly am, not this chaotic condition whereby any external thing can start a whole chain of thought with accompanying emotions because it has been conditioned to respond in that way. And gradually we begin to get free of chaotic condition, and as it slows down, we can see it more clearly and realize that it's not the way for us to go. And so this is even, if you suffer from great depression or you have an addiction of any kind, you get with practice, you are then able to make a choice of not going there. And this is, it's very powerful. It's not that you don't have the experience, but it's just that you let it be. You don't add You have the experience, which you definitely don't want to reject. You want to allow it in your body, recognize it, greet it, but you don't have to add the emotional content of, oh, here it goes again, I'm going down, you know, whatever, whatever the thought patterns that one has from one's conditioning. And you can actually just, it's possible to decide you won't go there. And that's not avoidance, because it comes through a clarity of seeing, a certain emotional, you could say, not detachment exactly, but not adding a story to what is the reality. There's a very well-known teacher, she's not a Buddhist, Byron Katie, and her one of her most cogent statements is that, you know, when you fight reality, you lose every time. And we actually spend a lot of our lives fighting where we are, fighting our reality. I don't like this, I don't want that, I don't want to be here, I wish I was home, you know, why is that person so annoying? Give me a break. I'm really uncomfortable. I want to go somewhere else. And that's the adding to the fact, which is that, yes, it's hot, or yes, I am really sad, or I'm very confused. All of that we can hold, we can go through it, we can experience it, because remember, this is our direct experience practice, but we don't have to add to it. And that's where our practice gives us that ability of detachment, and we can take a different direction. And why do we do that? It's because we have this sense that there's something that we need to find, something that is deeply there, but we just haven't maybe quite grasped it yet. Goes on into beyond duality. Here we have reached the culmination of the Buddha's teaching. We have dispensed, he's talking about losing conditioning, seeing through thoughts. We have dispensed with the conditions that hold us in thrall to the physical world. We are dealing with a phenomenon we have always been aware of but didn't realize was not part of the physical world. In other words, feelings. I think, as we said yesterday, maybe feelings is, you could use the word intuition, because it's a little more subtle in a way to, I think, what is expressed here. Intuitions about our relationship with any person or animal or plant are very subtle, precise, and don't require understanding. In fact, there are some, I'll use his feelings, but just think of intuition as well. Some feelings which you can't understand. This is spirit. Having reached this culmination point by disposing of most of these problems, we are beginning to see these feeling areas, and we become to discover the nature of consciousness, which we can only know by experience. It's actually so natural and simple, that's the joke of it, but it's not easy to achieve. In fact, I will state the opposite here. To attain this realization, to attain freedom, is the most difficult thing that anybody ever attempted in the whole wide world. To attain this realization, to attain freedom, is the most difficult thing that anybody ever attempted in the whole world. It's relatively easy to put an argument across and make somebody believe it, but to release ourselves from all these arguments is the most difficult thing in the world. To have a mind without thought, to know without thought, the Buddha teaches us to be still, to be silent. Stillness means no thought. But to be wholly conscious of the stillness and the apparent emptiness which is vast, that is very difficult. There is a biblical saying, "Seek ye the peace which lies beyond understanding." Beyond understanding, you can't think your way to it. Only practice the experience of it. It's already there. It must be realized that you can't experience spirituality in thought alone. It has to be an experience. Think about it all you like, it won't change a thing. But when you begin to realize through intuition, through awareness, everything will change. Thought is neither honest nor constructive. It's destructive because it takes you away from the real. The world is a mirror. Everything manifest is a mirror. Whatever quality you put out will be reflected back to you. That is what mindfulness is all about, to be well aware of the condition in here and make sure that what you give out is of the same nature. If you want to live peacefully, give peace. If you want chaos, put chaos out there and you'll soon get it back. If you are wise, you learn to be very, very gentle in almost everything you do. Then you get that subtlety of feeling, and it's the subtlety that matters most. It means slowing down somewhat, not allowing immediate response. Wait, be gentle. Does it really need a response? If it does, take it gently. There's no need to be tough. And also, whatever you do, give it your full, undivided attention. Often you come to know rather than understand. Thought has its place, nobody's denying this, but it must not be allowed to overtake everything else. There are times when we need to think about things, but if those times are not present, we don't have to think. If you stop thinking about them, they will still be there when you need them. But in between thoughts, you can learn to experience what is there. That is where living takes place. In thought, there is no living, only delusion. And in relation to having uncomfortable thoughts, somebody here reports, "Yesterday I felt really out of sorts, and suddenly I thought that if I could be at peace with where I am now, then it would be irrelevant what state I was in. And all of a sudden there was a bird flying by, and I could see the feathers on its wing. The body still felt uncomfortable, but the mind wasn't reacting to the discomfort anymore." Russell, "This is the truth of what the Buddha taught. Quote, what is the motivation for doing anything at all? The answer is, I am not content with where I am. I want to be something else. I want to get something else. I want to get rid of something because I'm not comfortable. If I were comfortable here, would I move from this chair to that because that one appears to be more comfortable? Unsatisfactory situations within oneself are the cause of everything. If we knew precisely who or what we were, we would be content with that. We wouldn't want to go anywhere, and we wouldn't need to pursue any ambitions. So we're not wholly content, and that's why we pursue other things to alleviate our discontent. Discontent is the ruling factor behind our activity. Unfortunately, since we don't see it clearly, all we know is that we're not very comfortable and something else looks better, so we go and chase that, or we possess it and hope we'll feel better. Perhaps we do for a while, but since we've taken our discomfort to the new situation, it turns to discomfort as well. So the whole of life is discomfort, moving from this to that, to that, to that, like a grasshopper. The whole point is to eliminate those factors that cause the dissatisfaction, which, truly speaking, is our concept of duality. I am lonely, therefore I need some sort of company. I'm not whole. There's something missing in my life. As I've already mentioned, there's nothing missing in your life. It was always there. You just never saw it. You looked into duality instead of the fullness of wholeness itself. And this very factor of not being content is the source of all of our problems. Since we have a conceptual area of duality, we assume that something is missing, and therefore we have to add to it. In the conditioned world, all these things are subject to change, as is the self. So this world is never going to be wholly satisfactory, and you're just building more discontent on discontent upon discontent to make it worse. The answer is to go deep within and ask yourself, why am I discontent? And then if you look deep down, you find that in fact there is no discontent at all. There is just an idea that has become a problem. We have to face up to our so-called problems, not run away from them. We must meet them where we stand, if possible, no matter what they may appear to be. They can't be stronger than you. Why? Because you are the one who created them in the first place. That doesn't mean that you created the terrible circumstances in which you may have found yourself. He's talking really about the add-ons that we, the add-ons in emotion that we put onto situations and things that we are into. And on this final note, I think I'll just read this short one on dealing with pain, since by this point in Sesshin, people are feeling it a little more than maybe they did yesterday. The question is, what is the best way to deal with pain? The body can know pain, but you don't have to know it. I've recently been experiencing that myself. He's 94 after all. There has been pain, but that doesn't mean I've suffered it. It's almost as if consciousness is an entity in its own right, separate from the body. It has its own life. Well, I'm not sure this is... I'm going to jump now to another paragraph where he says, according to Buddhism, in order to achieve peace, we have to rid ourselves of desires and aversions and all our sensual perceptions. You can't drink alcohol, can't have sex, you can't have this, you can't have that. He's talking to the Theravadan tradition. This Buddhist society of Manchester was founded by a woman who had strong links to Thailand and to the bhikkhus and the rules, monastic rules. So I think he's referring more to that aspect of Buddhism, being a Buddhist and following certain rules and things. But in actual fact, as you develop, the opposite occurs. Experience broadens rather than narrows. Everything which arises is interesting, infinitely interesting. Since there's less thinking about things, there is more experience of life. So, in fact, one begins to live life to the full for the first time. Interesting, isn't it? One lives life to the full for the first time because one is attuned to everything in the moment that it arises. Therefore, there is contentedness because there is union with everything. Hard to believe, isn't it? That is the truth of the matter. I think we'll leave it there. maybe the most one of the things to take away from this is the being rather than doing, and to be willing to explore very deeply and to get into our bodies more, to experience with our intuition, to practice deeply, to apply our concentration so that we can come to this stillness, which is the mind is basically still. So to get back there, you can't do it by thinking about it, obviously, as he said. And so having faith in our own ability, we all have this true nature. We need to uncover it. Nobody else can do it for you. Teacher can't. And being really empowered by that. What the heck if it takes a million years? It's the process of being in this practice, doing it, is all. We'll stop here now and recite the four vows.